Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and is the fear of being offensive suppressing free speech? My next guest thinks so, and he's written a book in defense of what he calls the right to be offensive. Mick Hume is the editor-at-large at Spiked, the British politics and culture magazine with a libertarian and, they say, humanist bent. Mick has been described as Britain's only libertarian Marxist newspaper columnist. Libertarian Marxist, and is the author of a new book, Trigger Warning: Is the Fear of Being Offensive Killing Free Speech? The word trigger and the term trigger warning, as many of you know, are heard a lot on college campuses these days in this context. Mick Hume, welcome to WNYC.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for having me.
About that description of you I quoted, do you embrace that? No one could be both a libertarian and a Marxist, really, right?
Well, I quite like it, Brian, because it tends to annoy all the right people on both sides of the political fence. But you know, Marx is a much misunderstood figure because he's always associated with the Stalinism and the Soviet Union. Actually, if you go back to the young Marx, the first thing he ever published as a newspaper columnist in Germany in the 1840s was a series of long essays called "The Freedom of the Press," attacking Prussian state censorship in exactly the same terms that I would do today, in which he upheld the right of the press to be disrespectful and offensive and said that you cannot clutch the rose without the thorn, which I think is a great slogan for anybody that wants to believe in press freedom in the 21st century.
So for the uninitiated, where did the use of that phrase trigger warning originate?
Well, the interesting thing about it is, Brian, it begins with online discussion groups for people who've had traumatic experiences and mental health issues, particularly those who experienced war and sexual violence. And the idea of a trigger warning was to alert somebody that what they were about to read or see might trigger a traumatic reaction in them. In other words, if they were a victim of sexual violence and they saw or read a description of sexual violence, it might trigger some traumatic episode. Now, those who are experts in this field will tell you that even that is a slightly simplified understanding of the way people's reactions are triggered. But what's interesting is that's now become generalised from being a specific experience of sexual violence or war to reading something that you might find offensive or upsetting, an opinion you don't agree with, has now become the subject of trigger warning. So I used it for the book because it's a kind of symbol of, I think, of a general trend of saying, don't go there, don't read this, don't think about that, stay in your comfort zone. It's a kind of, it reminds me of, you know, those old maps of the world, and uncharted areas would have something written on them that said, "Here be dragons." And I think a trigger warning is a bit like that. It's saying, don't step off the edge. Don't try anything new. Don't expose yourself to an opinion you might not like.
And you write in the book that several colleges, including Columbia here in New York, have considered adding trigger warnings to aspects of their syllabi and classes because of potentially, quote, triggering and offensive material. And I want to play a clip from an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate from earlier this year. This is Angus Johnston, a professor at the City University of New York, discussing how he uses trigger warnings in his own classes.
I also think that it is absolutely crucial to create an environment where everybody can participate in a classroom discussion. And part of that is recognizing that we all come into the classroom as whole people who have our own experiences. And so if I am talking about the murder and the desecration of the body of Emmett Till, I would kind of like to know whether one of my students has just lost a son. And if one of my students has just lost a son, I would talk about Emmett Till in a different way than I would under other circumstances. I don't think that my free speech is being violated if I make that choice.
So how can this, adding a few words of warning to help create a safe space for participating in the classroom, not be okay?
Well, you see, it all sounds very straightforward and simple there, doesn't it? Well, in the first place, even in its own terms, as with all these things, they are runaway trains. So you now have a situation where, as New Yorker magazine discussed a few months ago, you have law students objecting to the idea that they don't want to discuss rape law because it might have a traumatic effect on somebody in the class. Now, how can you be a law student and qualify as an attorney if there are areas of the law that you think are off limits and can't be discussed in honest terms? You also have classic works like The Great Gatsby that people want trigger warnings put on to dissuade people from reading it because it contains sexual violence and conflict. But more than that, you see, what I think, Brian, is it's not the trigger warnings themselves that are the be-all and end-all of the problem. They are simply a symbol of it. That's why I use it as the title for the book. Particularly on college campuses, the kind of language that professor was using about the fact that people have to be comfortable and safe in their studying environment has really been used to turn college campuses, which ought to be the most open-minded kind of bastions of free speech and freedom of thought, turn them into somewhere where you kind of barricade students off from ideas or opinions that they might be uncomfortable with from the outside world. And I think that's a very dangerous inversion of what the role of a college or a university ought to be. And it started in the States, it's spread across the Atlantic and all around the internet, and it's coming soon to a website near you.
Mick Hume is my guest, editor-at-large at Spiked, the British politics and culture magazine, author now of the book, Trigger Warning is the Fear of Being Offensive, Killing Free Speech. Listeners, maybe faculty members or current or recent college students, is this a phrase you know? Have you used this, like the professor we heard in the clip from City College, in your classrooms at all or as a student? Have you appreciated this? Have you rolled your eyes at trigger warnings? Do you think it stifles free speech more than it accommodates it? What do you think if you have any experience with this or the larger issues beyond trigger warnings themselves being raised by Mick Hume? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and take a call from a teacher. It's Mark in Babylon. Mark, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Hi, so I've been a teacher for the past half a decade, 6-7 years, with mostly students with extreme behavioral issues. And previously, before this, for about 5 years, I worked with students who had severe backgrounds of severe trauma, molestation, rape, sexual slavery experiences. I mean, you name it, it happened. And the school I was teaching at is very interesting because when I started my career there, it was a very kind of not addressing the trauma and the triggers. It was more like, you know, the attitude of some staff would be, you know, oh, get over it. You know, in the real world, no one will pamper you and no one will, you know, treat you with gloves on. You must get over this type of stuff. And then the school adopted a philosophy of embracing trigger warnings and having knowledge of a student's background in order to design curriculum and the way you would speak to students about this stuff. And from my point of view, besides just being, I think it's a great idea, you know, why not, you know, treat people the way they should be treated. But as a teacher, it would be to me, you know, if this is what the students are bringing in, why not, you know, address their strengths and weaknesses accordingly? You know, I would show, you know, people with severely, you know, backgrounds and witnesses of violence and victims, I would show them, you know, movies, or we would read books, you know, that had characters with these histories, and the students would often say, I'm getting triggered right now. And sometimes that would produce a violent episode in the school, or sometimes it would produce a beautiful moment where we would talk about it and kind of do some therapeutic, discourse about it. So overall, I think we should be sensitive and not do away with trigger warnings or not, adopt the belief that we're being weak or we're being offensive. I don't think it has the trigger warnings I think are good, and I think just a simple measure would be if you're a teacher, just get to know your students and learn about their triggers or have them fill out a form if they want to disclose anything that they think would prevent them from learning.
Mick, want to talk to Mark?
Well, the thing is, Mark, I don't know anything about the best method for teaching students with extreme experiences and severe trauma that you're talking about. I have nothing but respect for those who do. My point is really how something which you might judge as appropriate in that situation has now been generalised to situations where people want to apply it to classic works of literature, to law classes, to all kinds of classes where they are not teaching those kind of students, but they are simply dealing with situations where students are being exposed to ideas which are outside their comfort zone, which they might find as offensive or upsetting. That's my point. Something which begins as something to do with trauma is generalised into a situation where being exposed to an idea you're not comfortable with is itself seen as traumatic. So that in UK colleges, for example, on the same basis, you now have a song like Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines being right. banned from campuses because it's generally seen that this could trigger a reaction against anybody that's at a Friday night dance if they put this song on. That's the kind of dangerous mission
yeah.
creep, if you
I
like, that I'm talking
there,
about.
You know, dealing with my students, I would never shelter them. Like, because we were dealing with, you know, students with such backgrounds, it's not like we're saying, you know, this stuff doesn't exist and this stuff, you know, is not when we're going to hide everything
right.
from you. I agree with that you, you know, for people who don't have these backgrounds or, for lack of a better word, you know, normally adjusted adults, I think the approach of if you don't like it, change the channel is fine as long as it's not, you know, extremely racist and stuff in a private institution. You know, I think the change yeah. channel philosophy works.
Mike, thank you very much. Amy in Brooklyn, a CUNY professor. You're on WNYC. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience. I teach media studies from a feminist perspective. And on the one hand, I feel like a lot of my colleagues and I sort of went through the same training process, and particularly at CUNY, when we're dealing with such a diverse population, have worked very hard to be sensitive to all the different kinds of sort of gender differences and religious differences amongst our students to kind of let them know what's coming up in order to prepare them and foster a good discussion. On the other hand, I've noticed that a lot of the time trigger warning complaints by students, not necessarily at CUNY, but perhaps at more conservative institutions, are often levied against the most vulnerable professors. And in particular, and it's anecdotal, but I've heard of a large number of queer professors, professors of color and adjuncts, who might show something that pushes students, as your speaker talked about, out of their comfort zone, getting them accused of sexual harassment, being called into their departments because of complaints from students, and that there's kind of a chilling effect that happens, particularly kind of ironically, around issues of race, trauma, sexuality, the very thing trigger warnings were initiated to protect are being levied against professors who want to talk about those issues.
Huh. So how do you reconcile that apparent contradiction, that this, which was developed to protect people primarily from marginalized groups against unnecessary trauma, that this is being used against people from marginalized groups who are on the faculty, if that's really going on?
I think there needs to be sort of a strong statement about academic freedom and sort of strong policies about
Absolutely.
Academic freedom that's openly discussed. And I think there needs to be an acknowledgement that there's a great inequity in academia in terms of employment, and that there needs to be a conscious effort on the part of unions, on the part of administrations, to protect contingent faculty who are the ones who are, could potentially suffer from these problems. And one would hope that professors would always be sensitive to their students, but I don't know, this is an aspect of the discussion that I hadn't heard come up frequently, but that's what's happening in the field.
Amy, thank you very much. Mick, you were nodding in agreement there.
Well, I think academic freedom is absolutely crucial in this, and the right of academics or professors to teach their courses in the way that they feel best is absolutely crucial to any kind of open-minded academic environment. And I think one of the problems is you have a very inconsistent attitude where people tend to support academic freedom for the views that they agree with, and very few people are prepared to go across the board and uphold it as a principle. This is the same problem with free speech. And I think the thing about that your caller was talking about is evidently true, and it's also the case that trigger warning complaints are very often used against conservative professors too. Once you give anybody the green light and give them a kind of an access all areas ticket to demand a restriction on freedom of speech or freedom of discussion, then all kinds of people are going to pick up that ball and run with it. You know, and it's going to be used for in all kinds of purposes. And those who think that they can introduce a restriction on freedom of speech or discussion that will only affect the other side and they'll be protected from it are really kidding themselves.
In your discussion of terminology in your book, Of course, trigger warnings, which is in the title, is central, but also the term microaggressions, which we've talked about here on the show before. And here's an excerpt of a video by the New York Times explaining the concept of racial microaggressions.
Tiny offhand comments, the kind that can seem innocent but can really sting under the surface.
At the beginning of the year, introducing myself to people, sometimes people would take a step back and be like, wait, what are you?
They're called microaggressions, and younger generations are increasingly responding to them.
And acknowledging that these kinds of offenses, like the kind mentioned in the video, do actually happen or are experienced by people, what do you think of that term and the movement to combat microaggressions?
Well, I think it's really symptomatic of a general problem. I mean, on one hand, Brian, I think it's a complete trivialization of oppression to equate you know, the way someone looks at you or them asking you an uncomfortable question with the kind of systematic discrimination and oppression that people have fought against over the last two centuries. And perhaps it's a sign of how far things have come that those seeking for something to get angry about now are reduced to talking about microaggressions rather than social oppression. But more than that, what I think is that if you look at what history teaches, one of the things I try and do in the book is kind of reconnect people with the history of the fight for free speech and to remind people that in every liberation struggle of the last 200 years, from the American War of Independence, the American Revolution, through to the war against slavery, the fight against slavery, women's liberation, gay liberation, the demand for free speech was always central to those demands for emancipation and liberation and equality.
Right, but those demands for free speech were against power, not against the marginalized. And so I could argue that trigger warnings and sensitivity to microaggressions and what you consider oversensitivity in general actually might lead to more free speech, not less, because a lot of the point is to make people whose groups have been marginalized in the past more comfortable, women and many kinds of minorities especially, more comfortable that their voices can break through. So
but the point is,
if
Brian,
you
the,
as a white the, male feel yeah. a little less comfortable offending people, maybe on balance more people are going to express more free speech in total.
Well, it's a nice idea. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that, you see, because free speech is not a kind of zero-sum game where in order for you to have more free speech or somebody else to have more free speech, I have to have less of it. It can only be defended properly as a universal, indivisible liberty. And the point I'm making is that in the struggle for liberation, free speech has always been at the centre of it. You know, Frederick Douglass didn't write in 1861 his pamphlet, A Plea for Less Free Speech in Boston. OK, it was actually central to that struggle. And now you have a situation where instead those who claim to represent identity groups or oppressed groups are demanding less free speech and are demanding to be protected from words and from other people's language. I think that's a very dangerous idea.
An ongoing conversation in the UK as in the US. The latest entry into that discussion on this show coming today from Mick Hume from Spike magazine, the British politics and culture publication, and author now of the new book, Trigger Warning is the Fear of Being Offensive, Killing Free Speech. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, how to have a feminist wedding when you're marrying a man. Stay with us.